Hello and welcome to Dealcast, the M&A podcast from Merger Market. I'm Juliana Needham. In this episode, we're finding out about the latest fundraising trends in Asia. As the Lunar New Year gets underway, some may be hoping it draws a line under a challenging period that's seen a sharp drop in total capital raised in the region. So what does the year of the fire horse hold for private equity? Will Japan and India continue to be bright spots? Will the flight to quality and a preference for large pan-regional fund managers continue? And how are GPs diversifying their investor bases? Well, to find out more in this episode, Justin Niesner, the associate editor of the Asian Venture Capital Journal, or AVCJ, speaks to the publication's managing editor, Tim Burrows.
The topic of the day is fundraising in Asia. And I guess the point I want to get to first is this whole idea of global LPs diversifying away from US-centric portfolios to the benefit of Asia. I guess, you know, the received wisdom is that that is indeed happening. I mean, we've had a chaotic political environment in the US in the past couple of years, maybe especially the tariff regime, which has been quite erratic. And a lot of institutional investors, I mean, even if they're still making great returns in the US, they maybe see it as a less stable jurisdiction than they used to. And so there's a clear logic for diversifying away from that geographically globally. The evidence that that's actually happening in Asia is anecdotal and patchy at best. I mean, if we just look at AVCJ data, I mean, for the past couple of years, 2024 and 2025, probably the best years in recent memory, if not the best years ever for fundraising. Just in the overall figures, 2024 was $244 billion for private equity and venture capital funds raised in the region, down slightly in 2025 to $235 billion. But the plot twist is that most of that is renminbi-denominated funds. Historically, renminbi funds have been, you know, a big minority, but definitely a minority of overall fundraising in Asia. Now it's most of the fundraising. Obviously, that's really just a matter of global LPs rotating out of China specifically. And so therefore, the state institutional investors inside China are kind of pumping up government-oriented funds and really skewing the numbers. Really, the overall effect here is that non-renminbi fundraising is down. But maybe the most important point is that it hasn't fallen off a cliff. So there is some evidence that this idea of global LPs diversifying away from the US, doing a little bit more Asia, you know, that could be happening in Asia, but it's not lifting the numbers. It's really, if anything, just mitigating a drought. I'd be interested to hear what you think about this, Tim. I mean, and what you're seeing just in terms of how global LPs are looking at the region.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first observation to make is that fundraising globally for private equity is incredibly difficult. So no one is necessarily having it easy. And the argument people make is that perhaps Asia is having it harder than most. And the main reason for that is really that people have, and I'm generalizing here because obviously Asia, it breaks down into different markets with different dynamics, but people had exposure to Asia because they wanted diversification in their portfolios and they wanted growth. And to some extent, if you allocate into India and China, it was very much you were thinking about returns tomorrow rather than returns today. And if anything, what we have seen the last 24 months globally is people focus a lot more on the distributions, and where they're not seeing those distributions, they start reviewing whether they should have that relationship. And so for Asia, yes, you can get diversification if you come to Asia. That makes an important part of the portfolio. No one would dispute that. The question really is, has Asia delivered the return distributions you were expecting? And when you look at the managers that you have in your portfolio, can you so say with confidence that they will give you those distributions over the next sort of the next few years? And that's really the question with Asia. And that means people are being very selective.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. I mean, it's a good point about, I mean, diversification is the reason to come to Asia. I mean, historically, those are the reasons to come to Asia. If you're a global investor, you want the growth and you want the diversification. I suppose, you know, there's an emerging school of thought that there may be a third, you know, reason for global LPs to invest in Asia funds. And that is, it's kind of like the DeepSeek factor we saw with the AI company in China, DeepSeek. This idea of very capital efficient innovation. You can get good deals in Asia. You can get good valuations with good talent. You can invest in tech cheaper than you can in the US. So, you know, maybe that's an emerging draw card. I mean, we've seen in China, for example, you know, most of the funds that are being raised in China or the ones that are being launched anyway, just in the recent term, are more on the venture capital side. Is that a signal that tech is a draw for Asia in terms of, you know, the kinds of strategies that LPs favor in the region nowadays, or what other kind of strategies might be of interest? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, so we have to break that down in two ways. I mean, first of all, if you are an LP considering allocations to venture capital in Asia, because let's look at it that way, it's technology, then do you have an appetite for China or not? And if you do have appetite for China, that opens up a number of other sort of different avenues. And to your point, what we have seen is 2 years ago, pretty much no China managers were raising money at all. No one was even trying because they knew that the sentiment was that bad. What we have seen, I guess, post-DeepSeek, although some of it started a little bit before then, is the VCs come back to market and start raising money. We've seen one very successful final close. There are a few other managers who are expected to hit their targets, which might have been revised downwards anyway. But certainly there's a bit more interest in China VC than there was before. And you hear this from the LPs. You've got people who, you know, exactly what you said. You know, they look at the innovation happening in China. They look at the valuations and you think, well, I can get in on this interesting AI startup at a valuation that's so much lower than perhaps the equivalent in the US. Now, there's still going to be questions as to, you know, are you comfortable allocating to China? Are you comfortable with the geopolitics? How do you feel about the pathway to exit? Where's the IPO going to happen? How quickly can it happen? So those are all absolutely valid questions that people would like to get answers to. But certainly at the margins, we're seeing a bit more interest in China than we did before. Caveat, interest was very, very low. So we're talking from a low base.
It might be too early to say that tech is a major draw card in terms of bringing global LPs into the Asia funds, though. I guess the biggest trend in Asia fundraising is this gravity towards the pan-regional players. I think in 2025, 30% of all fundraising raised for the region went into the largest pan-regional players. We're talking about a few names, a group of funds you can count on one hand, right? So it's really pan-regional strategies that are dominating rather than like a specific tech strategy, like a venture strategy.
Yeah, absolutely. So that 30% number, and so that's for that's Asia fundraising, excluding renminbi strategies. So normally, that percentage is in the teens, and sometimes low teens. To see it get to 30 is very unusual. And to see it get to 30, and most of that 30 being two funds, is unprecedented. So, and it has nothing to do with technology, beyond the fact that pretty much everyone who's investing in private equity now, every private equity firm has to sort of think about technology disruption to their companies. That's really about, first of all, size. So there are LPs that cannot write checks below 100, 200 million. And that means that, you know, some country funds are really not possible. Two, comfort. Do you really want to put your money on a single country when you can put it on an entire region? So if there are, you know, problems with geopolitics in China, problems with valuations in India, problems with governance in Southeast Asia, it allows you to, as a pan-regional investor, you can sort of pivot to different markets. So for the LP, that intrinsically might be a bit more comfort. And then I guess those two managers, and it is EQT, Blackstone, and it's not in the numbers for 2025, but the other one with a lot of traction would be Bain. Recent vintages, there's not a lot of China in those funds, if any. I think Blackstone and EQT, negligible, Bain a little bit. And if you look at the recent performance, those managers have done okay with their Asia funds. So to a certain extent, you might be able to make the case that if you are pan-regional, you haven't done much China, and you've got a good track record, then yeah, you're going to perhaps get a bit of an LP following.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I mean, I've heard a lot of feedback from LPs in the past year or so that, yes, a lot of the money globally is congregating into these largest pan-regional fund managers. But still, I mean, the fewer people are actually doing that strategy. I mean, there's fewer funds that are willing to take a kind of cross-border regional approach. I mean, it used to be, I suppose, a lot of managers in Asia would claim a regional footprint or a global footprint, and they say that they could bounce off that and create synergies and take learnings from different regions. I think the thinking is that there's going to be less of that going forward, just because it's getting harder to do cross-border deals in a slightly deglobalizing world. And so cross-border kind of strategies and funds that might normally leverage that an office in several different countries, that may become more of a niche offering. And we might see a rise of more country funds. I mean, it's certainly, you can see it in Asia. I mean, Australia, India, and Japan are the hotspots. And these are all country funds. So you can kind of see already that kind of country fund mentality coming into it.
Yeah, I mean, I have to disagree with you on one point there. If you are a global GP doing deals in different Asian markets, part of your value add is the fact that you have global capabilities. So whilst there has been a pivot to perhaps more domestic plays in certain markets to sort of remove some of that cross-border risk, it's never going to disappear. So I think if you're a global GP and you're doing a deal in Japan, one of the big sort of carve-outs, that asset you're carving out is probably going to have some kind of global business. So it's very hard to think get away from that. I'm investing in Asia, but my network, my experience is global. I think that's still going to be a point of differentiation for them, especially if you're operating at size. I do agree that, yeah, the markets that are popular right now on a country fund basis would be Japan and India. And it just so happens that the managers we've discussed, the pan-regional guys, those in different ways have done pretty well in Japan and India. So that's where some of the recent good outcomes have come from. So yeah, I guess that, you know, it's logical that a pan-regional manager active in those markets would perhaps get more traction when fundraising.
Yeah, a lot of the feedback that I've gotten from LPs in the past year or so, and you may be able to corroborate this, Tim, is just that there's a lot more interest, or it seems like there's a lot more interest in specialization. I mean, I guess this kind of speaks to the value creation mantra that markets are growing more slowly. I mean, you know, the growth markets of Asia are growing more slowly, and so there's more reliance on value creation. And to be a specialist kind of assists that value creation. And, you know, I mean, I guess historically it was always tech and healthcare and consumer were kind of the main areas of specialization, but we may see some different areas of specialization, energy transition, AI, and related AI value chains. One of the other areas of specialization that appears to be gaining traction is manufacturing, reshoring, which kind of speaks to the difficulties with cross-border. So it seems like there's demand from that, from the LP community. I mean, we certainly heard that at our event in Hong Kong last November. A lot of LPs were talking about liking specialization. So there could be some funds that are launched to meet that demand.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you are operating in an environment where the rising tide is not floating all boats, you need to have some kind of demonstrable edge. And so, yeah, that does lend itself to specialization. And yeah, we do see that to a certain extent. It's often quite hard to pin down because, yes, you do get specialist managers who just do one sector. You also get managers who say they've become increasingly specialized, which means they used to do like, you know, eight sectors and now they're doing four. So, and if those four are industrials, financial services, healthcare, and consumer, then obviously that can be quite a broad swath of any economy.
Yeah, let's talk about Japan, because obviously it's been the hotspot of the region. I mean, there's a lot of country funds in Japan. In a way, it's a specialization of its own. But that's definitely been kind of the story for Asia. And it's a developed market. I mean, and there's a lot of reasons for that to be the most attractive market in the current environment. A stable market, a lot of opportunities in the kind of middle market deal space, activist shareholders creating pressure for undermanaged companies. There's the whole theme around corporations selling their subsidiaries and PE firms carving them out. One of the things that I thought was really interesting about the Japan story that maybe doesn't get talked about quite as much as some of those other deal drivers is just this whole upside around the digital transformation, which I know you and I, Tim, have been covering this from various angles for the last few years. But it's a real theme in Japan that I think kind of creates an attractive upside for a lot of people. I mean, if you look at, I think on the Tokyo Stock Exchange, you look at there's some 4,000 companies or so on the Tokyo Stock Exchange, 40% of them about are trading below 1x price to book ratio. And there's a few different ways you can interpret that. I mean, you can say maybe these are companies that are a bargain on a case-by-case basis. You could say it's a bargain, or you could say it's buyer beware. But I think across the board, it's really telling us that these are companies that have inefficiencies. These are companies that need to upgrade to digital operations. And that's a huge upside for private equity. And I think a lot of LPs can see that, and they want to play into the digital transformation theme in Japan. So we've got these deal drivers in the market, but maybe you can take us a little deeper on that, Tim. I mean, what have you heard from the market about why Japan is of interest, and where's that going, actually?
Yeah, I mean, I think the observation you made there is a good one. Actually, more in the context of specialization, because we've talked about sector specialization. You've also got functional expertise. You've got a functional specialization element to it. So, and increasingly, if you're a GP and you want to be taken seriously, you need to be across stuff like AI. You need to be across stuff, automation within your portfolio companies, all that kind of stuff. That, I think, is increasingly table stakes. So I think if a Japanese GP was marketing themselves and they weren't talking about digitalization of the economy, that would probably be a bit strange. So I think that was probably an expected sort of touch point for most GPs. But for Japan generally, yeah, it's the one market where it seems that everyone is oversubscribed. There's macro trends that you mentioned. So one of them you mentioned, the other one would be the corporate carve-outs. You mentioned the activists. So basically, there are a lot of reasons why there are going to be more deals in Japan than there have been in previous cycles. And so people are excited about that. So yes, you can build a fundraiser around that. Also, Japan, I think the mid-market, they've had pretty good exits. So there, for the most part, those managers, and it's not, I mean, make one thing very clear, it's not a huge, deep GP landscape. It's not, it never has been. But the managers there have reasonable track records, so that sort of helps with the fundraising. So yeah, I mean, there is a lot of demand for Japan. Possibly people are raising too much money. Maybe that sort of pushes them into going after deal types that are sort of not typically what they're used to doing, and maybe that's going to cause some problems. We don't know. Certainly, we've seen that happen in other markets in the past. So, a lot of interest in Japan, but the question is, where does it go? I guess that also plays into that idea of a pivot to developed Asia. I'm not sure to what extent that's come up in your conversations as well. The idea that, and this has been around for a while, a hypothetical LP has an Asian allocation, thinks China's a bit too difficult right now, so wants to put that money elsewhere. And so it's sort of the LP thinks, well, I'm going to go with markets that are more developed, markets where there are more buyouts, markets where the managers have more control over when and where the exits will come. And that just makes it a bit more comfortable. So I'm not sure to what extent that's something you've been hearing as well.
Yeah, that's definitely the feedback. I mean, ostensibly Japan is the safe bet. And so that's the conservative bet. It's the developed part of Asia. At the same time, I mean, we are seeing people take risks within that market. I mean, one of the themes in Japan is the growth of the venture capital space. And there's been a lot of global money going into the venture capital space. And there's about a half a dozen, quite sizable and experienced venture capital funds or fund managers in Japan that are definitely starting to get more global money. But even really small ones that you may not have heard of that are incubators and accelerators are starting to get global money. So that's really interesting. And just in terms of taking risks in Japan, I mean, we're interested in developed Asia and Japan reflects that, but within that, we're still seeing some risk taking. There was been a lot of fund ones in Japan in the past year. And I think a lot of that is domestic money, but I think there is a lot of global money going into fund ones. J Inc., I think, is a good example, right?
Yeah. The spin-out from the spin-out, yeah. So, yes. And I do see VC slightly differently to the private equity space, but yeah, there is a lot more domestic LP appetite for private equity in Japan than there was previously. So you know, you go back maybe three cycles, might be more now, a lot of those local managers were actively trying to raise more money overseas, and the Japan share of their funds was sort of going below 50%. Typically what happens now is it's well above 50%, because there's just a lot more demand there. And that's kind of a structural trend, but it's sort of also, in a weird way, or maybe a not so weird way, gives comfort to global LPs. I mean, if you're a global LP and you've never allocated to a country before, one thing you're going to look at is, are local LPs allocating to local managers, and which ones? Because the idea being that the local money, to a certain extent, might be the smart money, where it's at least going to know the local environment. So, yeah, having that certainly doesn't help. On the other side, it just means there's less space for the international LPs to come in. So if, for example, and this, say, for example, I think that there are situations like this. So say I'm raising a fund of 200 million, 175 of that is local, and 25 of that is international. And I'm not sort of going to move that those allocations very much. That means you've got a lot of foreign capital competing for a relatively small portion of the overall fund. And that is sort of why you get this quite weird, this very competitive dynamic in Japan when it comes to global LPs wanting to identify the next great manager. And maybe that does mean that they're more likely to look at a fund one.
It's interesting. I mean, for the past year, we've talked about Japan and India as kind of the twin hotspots of Asia fundraising and Asia private equity activity in general. This story we're talking about in Japan doesn't quite translate into Asia. We've got quite a different narrative in Asia. A lot of the enthusiasm in India kind of centering around this really buoyant public markets activity. I mean, long time exits were the big problem in India. That appears to be sorted, I mean, to a lot of people's satisfaction. And so we have seen it's still dismal compared to historical numbers, but year on year, fundraising is up in India, at least. It's up year on year, but it's still a 7-year low. So, you know, it's I guess the question is, you know, is this kind of resurgence sustainable? India's role as a hotspot in the region. Just kind of my headline thoughts around it. Pre-COVID, we had a lot of global hedge funds kind of, you know, pumping money into the consumer internet plays in India, blowing up valuations in the public markets and the private markets. Post-COVID, that money has been replaced mostly by domestic mutual funds. We've got these popular auto debit investment instruments that are just in household savings going into the systematic investment plan, household savings going into these mutual funds. That's running the public markets, that's running the private equity exits, and it's creating this environment that seems a lot more sustainable than the hot money we had before COVID. So it seems like we've got a long-term kind of secular story with this private equity story in India, but the jury is still out. Have you been getting feedback from people in terms of like where that's going?
Yeah, the exit situation, the liquidity situation is great, and everyone knows that, everyone likes that. Whether that is sustainable long-term, I don't know. How that filters through into private equity fundraising is a bit different. What we continue to, and this is why that, you know, you mentioned the India fundraising numbers being kind of all over the place. The reason for that is, in terms of international LPs that still account for most of the money going into Indian private equity, at least for now. I mean, obviously, long-term, yes, we expect to see more local LP activity. But for now, most money is global. And in private equity, the global LPs seem to favor a relatively small number of Indian GPs. And there's only, two managers that have gone past $1 billion in fund size in the private equity space. And so whenever those guys are in the market, your overall fundraising number is going to be high. When they're not, it's going to be low. So that is definitely something that you should bear in mind about India, is that, you know, if a Chris Capital is raising, if a Kadar is raising, that those funds are large and they're oversubscribed, or large by India country fund standards. And then you've got others that have got smaller funds. And that's kind of a result of the difficulties India went through sort of 10 plus years ago, where there was a bit of a reset in the GP landscape because the returns had been poor. And the managers that survived were the ones that sort of thought a bit more carefully about how they were going to position themselves. And so when global LPs are making their allocations to India, you could argue they're being quite conservative and they're sticking with a handful of managers they know well. So I think that, you know, the liquidity environment's great. It's great for the VCs. It's great for private equity as well. It's great for the pan-regional funds. I mean, you can now do a sell down in India in the public market, like a block trade, that's $1 billion. You couldn't have done that 5 years ago. So if you are an EQT or a Blackstone and you've got something that's listed, you can exit it in an orderly way, which you couldn't before, something of scale. So the public markets are good for everyone. Right now, that does not necessarily translate into private equity fundraising being good for every country manager.
Yeah, that's right. It's really been concentrated. I guess that it really raises the question, like what happens with these big funds? I mean, we've got just two or three funds that have eclipsed $1 billion. Is there enough deal flow for these managers? Are they going to have to change the way they invest? I mean, if they're traditionally sourcing deals in the big hubs, are they going to have to go deeper? Are they going to have to go into the so-called Bharat kind of regional and lower tier cities and that mass market, a part of the economy that's been so difficult for private business models to address? Are they going to be able to source deals in that part of the economy and put these big war chests to work? I think that's the longer term question, which nobody can really answer, but it's going to have to play out over a longer period, certainly a longer period of time than whatever cycle will play through with this public markets activity.
I mean, the answer you tend to get on that is they are changing the way they invest and they want to do more control deals and they want to do larger deals. So it's not necessarily you're pushing into parts of India geographically where you were before. It's that you are going after what you see as a larger opportunity set. Now, I don't know how that plays out because there's a reason, the other reason you don't have a lot of Indian managers who are over $1 billion in size is because a lot of the pan-regional global guys actually, they sized down in India in terms of what they would look at. So that upper middle market, they ended up doing a lot of the deals. So if you are a local manager and you're scaling in fund size, you're going to compete with those guys a bit more often. Maybe there's enough to go around, maybe there's not, I don't know. But yeah, I think what you hear is we expect to do more control deals, and that means doing more deals of size. We see big picture trends around succession, businesses becoming available that weren't available before, that kind of thing. And again, you know, have to see how it plays out.
Back to the elephant in the room, which is China. And we spoke earlier about more recent fundraising activity that's happened there. It's been in the VC space. There's a lot of enthusiasm around the tech scene in China. That's part of the story. We've also seen a bit more M&A. We've seen some more buyouts. I mean, there was the big Starbucks deal not long ago. And we've seen some pretty active IPO activity. So a bit of return to form, at least in theory, in China, and a bit more optimism. The question is whether that's translating into fundraising. I mean, whether that's translating into LP appetite. And if not, how long? I mean, what's the warm-up for global LPs coming back to China? I mean, my feedback that I've gotten from talking to people is that, yes, global LPs will come back to China, but it's going to be a gradual process. They're not going to flood back in. So all of these kind of exciting traction we're seeing in public markets and technology and M&A is not going to make them rush into funds. What's the feedback on your side, Tim? I mean, as far as global LPs coming back to China?
I'd agree with what you said. It's gradual. Certainly some of the people that I've heard be most positive, perhaps unsurprisingly, are the endowment and foundations, because that's generally, you know, that's how they normally behave. And they're the ones that, you know, and a lot of the talk has been around VC. So if we leave VC, if we put VC to one side and we look at the private equity, we haven't seen in the last year or so, more than that, in fact, any China private equity manager try to successfully raise or even really try to raise a large country fund. I mean, a number presumably will have to come back to market this year and next year because they'll be running out of money. But those GPs that have in recent years almost tried to pivot a bit to be China Nexus, to be, yes, we do China, but we now invest offshore. We do more offshore, or maybe we only do stuff offshore that has some kind of China angle to it, has a Chinese founder, has a China supply chain or distribution angle to it. Those guys have yet to come back to market. And when they do, we'll really know what the appetite is, because I think you've got to look at the VC and the PE in as two sort of different animals there. So yeah, remains to be seen. Certainly all Chinese managers, whether they're fundraising or not, have thought about what the LP base is likely to look like next time and whether certain geographies will be less well represented than before. And so let me chuck that question back to you. If you are a Chinese GP coming back to market, what are you sort of thinking about in terms of where you're going to raise the money from? Because maybe those US LPs that have been with you for funds 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, maybe 6 is a bit too many, maybe they're not going to come back.
Yeah, no, that's a good point, Tim. I kind of think that this is almost an Asia-wide question. I mean, if you're a China GP and you're looking for new sources of fundraising, investment, new LPs, I mean, this is something that everyone's doing across the region. I mean, I think for a lot of markets, and I guess maybe especially China, but across the region, people have been looking increasingly towards the Middle East. They've been looking increasingly towards the kind of wealth channel investors in their domestic markets. We've seen some large organizations across the region that maybe haven't historically invested in private equity starting to do private equity more frequently for the first time. I mean, one of the best examples that I can think of in this regard, and it's not in China, but it is developing Asia, which is the new Creador fund, which I think is Creador 6, which is emerging Asia. The strategy is 60% Southeast Asia, 40% India. And they've got new LPs from the Middle East, new LPs from North America, new LPs that they've never had from Japan that are seeing a lot more connective tissue between their economies and India and Southeast Asia. So yeah, it's taking a bigger spread geographically and different kinds of organizations. Sovereign wealth funds is another example. We've seen a few different sovereign wealth funds come online in the region and globally that are expressing an interest in private equity and Asian private equity in particular. And some of them are quite interesting. I've spoken with people from Central Asia and Africa investing in Hong Kong-based private fund managers. There's a lot of large institutions in Japan coming online in terms of doing more private equity.
Yeah, no, I echo that. I mean, let's start with the Middle East. Obviously, everyone wants to raise money there globally. If you are an Asian manager who hasn't raised money there before, I think you've got to think carefully about who you're going to, because there are some very large sovereigns that will want to write checks that are just far too big for your fund if you're a country manager in certain Asian markets. And then you've got to think about what are you giving to the Middle East? I mean, okay, you want to raise money from them. Are you taking your portfolio companies there? Is there some kind of region-to-region interaction you can sort of highlight there? And that really does help. But yeah, and I think that that's kind of a reasonably well-established trend. The point you made about Asia, I think, is great, because it's, I think, and I'm not saying it at all, that it's going to replace the quantum of capital raised out of North America, but Asian managers raising more money from Asian LPs, I think, is an interesting trend worth watching. I mean, first of all, global GPs are targeting Asian LPs simply because they're seeing more LPs start to allocate to private markets, and those programs sort of maturing. So they are bigger targets for everyone. And then if you're a manager within Asia, yeah, perhaps you have a certain angle there. So yeah, I think Asia is an interesting target for Asian managers.
I think that is unassailable logic, Tim. So, I think
obviously that's not domestic. So yeah, I think the point there is there are LPs in certain markets that will always allocate to managers in their own markets. I was talking more about Asian LPs allocating to managers in other parts of Asia.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's always been the issue, hasn't it? I mean, especially with the kind of global downturn that we've seen in fundraising, if you're an Asian manager and you can't count on Asian LPs, who have you got left? But I mean, at least they are trickling in.
Yeah, and historically in certain markets, you couldn't count on those LPs anyway, because they just weren't big participants in private markets. So the fact they are now bigger participants is, you know, it's absolutely great for everyone, really. Hopefully great for the LPs as well, because they'll get different kinds of returns. But yeah, it's certainly something that should give managers in the region a bit more confidence, I guess.
Yeah, we'll see how that plays out.
We're talking change at the margins. Depending on your fund size, you know, you still have to look at fundraising as a global exercise. And you're never going to be able to sort of say, I'm just going to raise money out of Asia. You still need to sort of think about very carefully about, if you are going to market in the US, who you're going to target, who are the most likely people to be interested in your strategy. And the same for Europe. And it really is, I mean, you know, going back to that initial point about it being a very selective market, LPs are not re-upping with everyone, especially if they've not got the distributions, and so their budgets are somewhat constrained. So they're being a lot more careful about who they allocate to. And so on the flip side, if you're the GP and you're marketing, you have to be very selective, I think, in terms of the kinds of LPs you meaningfully target and how you target them.
Certainly for the larger funds. I mean, if we're talking about these kind of local Japan funds that have all domestic LPs, I mean, that story will always continue. But I mean, there's a point where you have to think global, especially if you want to be competitive in this current fundraising environment.
Yeah, and also, I guess, you know, you can raise all the money you like from Japanese LPs as being a Japanese GP, but ultimately, you might want some kind of diversification in your LP base.
That's right, yeah. I mean, once you get to Fund 3, Fund 4, you're definitely going to be in that mindset. Thanks for the chat, Tim. I think we'll have to leave it there.
That was AVCJ's Tim Burrows speaking to Justin Niesner. Thanks for listening to this episode of Dealcast, the M&A podcast from Merger Market. For more information about what's been discussed on this episode, have a look at our show notes. Join us again next week.